Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Well, first I want to apologize for the sound quality, which no doubt sounds terrible. But there is a 10-car accident on the Bay Bridge, and there I am sitting in it. But I want to do what I can to bring it with you, hopefully better some sound than no sound. John Rossman was a partner at Arthur Andersen, and he spent 4 years as an executive at Amazon, where he was responsible for managing worldwide services to Target, Toys R Us, Sears, NBA. And now he's written a book called The Amazon Way. He is a managing director at a company called Alvarez & Marsal, which specializes in technology strategy. And his clients include the Gates Foundation, Microsoft, several of the world's leading retailers. Why is he on the show? That book, The Amazon Way, has got all kinds of interesting things to say, good and not so good necessarily, about Amazon, and it may offer some implications for you in your career or your business. John Rossman, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Marty, thank you very much for having me today.
My pleasure indeed. Well, you say that Jeff Bezos, Amazon CEO, demands that its leaders have command of the details. Well, many people say that's not conventional wisdom. Managers and leaders need to focus on the big picture. Why do you think Bezos demands his leaders be in command of details?
Well, I'd say there's several reasons. You know, Amazon competes on price and is inherently a low margin company, and so the details around effectiveness and quality are essential in, you know, being able to do that successfully and still make a profit and still have some margin. So I think that that's, you know, one good reason. And I think the second is the commitment to obsessing about customer experience and doing whatever it can to make every single, you know, whether it's order or website experience or return or customer service interaction, the best that it can be. And it's by working to make every single one of those excellent that, you know, overall the system improves. And, you know, maybe the third one is just that, you know, leaders set an organizational tone. And if leaders really understand the details, then everybody else understands that also.
Well, let me understand. I mean, I can certainly understand why, you know, your frontline worker needs to sweat the details to get everything right. But, you know, why would the manager, the leaders, need to sweat all those little details? Isn't that what delegation is all about?
Well, in some ways, yes. But in some ways, you know, if you think of kind of the canary in the coal mine approach of, well, if this one error can happen, if this one order can have an issue, if this one customer can be disappointed, there's a bigger systems problem going on. And so it's by really understanding the details around that that then management, and this is management's job, can put in place how do we correct these things on a you know, company-wide, on a systems-wide basis. And so I think that's kind of the essence of understanding the details.
So, yeah, so in essence, you know, very often a screw-up at, you know, at the micro level is not a one-off, but rather a symptom of a larger systemic problem. That's your point?
Exactly. And when you run businesses at scale, if you know, you have one, you know, what seems to be minor inefficiency, you put that through the magnifying glass of a large business, that really adds up over time.
Yeah. I want to turn to one of the major criticisms of Amazon that got a lot of terrible press worldwide, that its workers at the warehouse level are working longer and harder with a lot of metrics about, you know, how many steps you're supposed to take or how many packages you're supposed to load per day than its competitors like Costco or UPS. As a guy who was in Amazon for 4 years as an executive, do you think that's a fair criticism?
yeah, potentially. I'd say it's not only the warehouse workers that work extremely hard, but I think the entire company and the culture is a very hard-working you know, culture. And I don't know all the facts within the warehouse and how it compares to its competitors, but, you know, I know that it is definitely Amazon's nature to always be trying to do more with less. And, you know, maybe in this, you know, in this case, they've kind of pushed it to its limit, and they need to make some adjustments in the favor of the worker versus, you know, business efficiency.
There's always two schools of thought on this. One is that, indeed, we have to be humane and balance, allow work-life balance, and that workers are human beings and not just fungible work units. And the other is that not every company or not every organization is the same. There are some workplaces that have a culture of, that is laid back, and you know everybody goes home at 3 o'clock, go to the kids' side, and that's fine, and that's something to be celebrated. And there are other workplace environments that are driving. There's some people who love working 80 hours a week, and shouldn't we allow the full range of workplaces? Nobody's forcing anybody to work at Company A versus Company B. What's your thought about that?
Yeah, I think there are all different types of company cultures, and I think that what happens at Amazon in the corporate culture isn't necessarily the right or the long-term sustainable thing of what it needs to be doing in the warehouses. And again, maybe this is a case where they need to, you know, stop looking at the numbers quite as much and understand it through the quality of life of its workers.
Yeah, you could be right. I do recall when I did interview Jack Welch, the CEO of GE, and he defended his, you know, he was called Neutron Jack for, you know, firing lots of people, and he says, you know, not everybody is meant to work at GE. They can work at other places, but our workplace culture is we only want to keep the very best. And there was something compelling about that, but there's also something dehumanizing about it. It's one of the endless dilemmas we face. Let me turn to another question. You know, you say that Amazon is obsessed with customer service, and you give it an example in your book, The Amazon Way, that when Amazon ran short of pink iPods right before Christmas, they went out and bought 4,000 of those pink iPads at retail so that they didn't have to disappoint their customers. But small companies can't afford to do that. Isn't Amazon going to put nearly all companies out of business? It has small companies, like almost all bookstores, are out of business. And is it really in society's best interest to put all those small companies out of business?
Well, no doubt Amazon's going to continue to grow and capture a bigger piece of, you know, a fairly stagnant, you know, retail business. And so, you know, I think they're putting the pain on a lot of retail companies, both big and small, and that's going to continue, and it's painful and everything. But I do think that there are definitely ways that retailers, small retailers, mid-sized retailers, large retailers can compete. And you know, some of the things that I see working are just that, you know, service is key, and you know, being able to offer unique products, customization of products, service around products, unique selection, and in a way that helps, you know, create community and connectiveness between customers. Those are not Amazon's strengths and typical approaches. And so I think that those are some of the things you think about in order to compete in retail today.
You talk about service and selection. If I go to my local store, even my local, your local little department store, I have to drive, I got to find a parking spot. If I want to return something, I got to wait in line. Then they're going to say, you know, it's pain. Whereas if I buy something on Amazon, I just, you know, they always say returns are easy, and every receipt I get says returns are easy, and you just, you know, you return it. You know, you're not having to drive anywhere. In terms of selection, you know, nobody's got bigger selection than Amazon. If I'm a small retailer in anything, from even clothing, you know, it feels like I'd be scared to start and open a boutique when I'm competing with Monster Amazon that's got that huge buying power and can sell cheap and available in every size. If I go to a new boutique, the odds are they're going to have my exact size, color, and style are tiny. And Amazon, I know exactly what they've got. I'm worrying, you know, in a way I love Amazon, but in a way I'm worried that nobody could compete with an Amazon. What's your thought about that, really?
Well, I think that there are a lot of retailers having success today, and I think a lot of them are having success with Amazon, right? So I think there's over 2 million third-party sellers selling at Amazon today, and so you know, everything you say is true, but yet, you know, they don't have all of the selection, and people like the experience of browsing and touching and talking to somebody, and so I think there continues to be a lot of different ways to differentiate, and people don't want to buy all from one company.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nimco. I'm talking with Don Rossman. He's the author of The Amazon Way, a book that describes 14 kind of techniques, some obvious, some not, for what managers and leaders could learn from the way Amazon does stuff. You talk about the fact that businesses can use Amazon as a part of their own business. Now, that's something like you call that it's a platform company. So let's say, for example, if I own a chocolate company, how could I, a small little chocolate company, how could I use Amazon's platform to help me in running?
Interesting. Yeah, I think there's a lot of ways. One I already mentioned, which is selling on Amazon. That was a business I launched in 2002, so that's sellers selling at Amazon.com. And that's a way to reach, over 200 million active customers of Amazon and create new relationships. And so that's a great one. The second one is through a capability called Fulfillment by Amazon. And so, typically people who are in the retailing business, they have to own warehouses, operate them, be good at it, and everything. You can use Amazon's fulfillment network, have your goods stored in their warehouse, and when you get an order, Amazon fulfills it in a very efficient manner. And, that is a way that you can leverage Amazon as a capability. And, the third way is maybe a little bit, more subtle, which is Amazon has a big business called Amazon Web Services, and Amazon Web Services are cloud capabilities that let you use technology infrastructure, by the byte or as you want to use it, versus having to acquire and own and operate computers, networks, applications. And so it's a real flexible and cost-effective way to ramp up your technology capability using Amazon Web Services.
Let me try to understand that. So I've got my little chocolate business. I manufacture artisan chocolate, and I hear something about Amazon Web Services that might save me having to buy a lot of computers and expensive software like Salesforce or whatever. How do I use, why am I better off using Amazon Web Services? The reason I'm asking for my I want my clients to understand how critical especially in a web-based business, how critical it can be to utilize these kind of state-of-the-art pieces of software. Tell us about it. How I might.
Sure. So imagine you're planning a big promotion, and that promotion is going to put a lot of traffic to your website and to your back-end systems. And what you'd normally have to do is plan that out long in advance. You'd have to be good at guessing how much that's going to increase your need for computer infrastructure. You'd have to purchase it, put it in place, and be ready for your launch. And then after the launch and the traffic kind of goes back to normal, you own that on an ongoing basis. What Amazon Web Services allows you to do is, in a relatively easy way, procure, provision that IT infrastructure, pay for it when you use it, and then dial it back down, not pay for it, when your promotion is over. So it's a nice way to be able to scale IT capability as you need it and not have to be extremely good at it all.
I have many listeners are completely outside of the technical world. They're psychologists and teachers and artists and the like. So they may not even know what the back end means. Could you describe what a typical business's back end looks like? What does it mean? What does it do?
Sure. So, first you'd have the computers, the servers that your data and your technology and your websites run on, and then you have the databases that store and segment the data and make it retrievable and usable over time. And then on top of those databases, you have applications. So whether it's your website or your order management system or your financial system. You have the applications that run on top of those other things. So those are kind of the main components of the type of IT back-end services that you're looking at.
We keep hearing all the time about the importance of big data, that companies are using ever more data to drive what they make, how much they make it, how they market it, or whatever. Could you give us a little introduction to the whole notion of how companies, small companies, are using and or should be using big data in order to drive their business? Because I give my listeners some guidance about careers they can pursue, how they might run their business a little differently. Give us a little idea about, in the real world, how a small business might utilize big data and various software to drive its decisions about what to sell and how to sell it.
Yeah, so, you know, what a lot of, you know, small companies are doing is, you know, they maybe understand their customers and their business, you know, channel by channel. I understand how I'm selling and my customers at the store, and I understand them at my website. And maybe I sell through some other channels, like I sell at eBay or I sell at Amazon or I sell at some other websites or distributors. But, you know, now what's important is bringing all of that data together and understanding, you know, what's common, do I have customers across multiple channels, and understanding your customers, your competitors, and you know, your products better. And so that's, you know, would be a nice combination of data there. And then I think the other things you can start doing is looking at the other types of data that can bring you insight that combine to it. You know, maybe it's it could be some type of economic data, or it could be weather-related data, or it could be competitor-based data, or it could be understanding your customers, you know, and their social interactions, you know, on Facebook, on Twitter. But you start combining those things together, that data together, and that's really the essence of big data, is bringing together, you know, kind of non-obvious or non-traditional data types together to draw insights to help you make better decisions.
And if it's just small, you're low-tech, not-sophisticated small business, or a nonprofit, or whatever I am, how do I get started? What do I need to do?
Well, I think you know, the first thing I'd think about is, do I have the right basic applications in place in my core processes? So maybe that's in my, you know, order management software, or in my financial processes, or in my customer management processes. And making sure that you have, you know, the right application software does two important things for you to get started with. First, it's going to drive efficiencies so that people aren't re-entering data. It improves data quality. It reduces manual effort. But the second thing that you should try to do as you put in that application data is be able to measure your processes. Where are my errors? How efficient am I? What's my throughput? What's my cost per customer, my cost per order? And when you start understanding your business and how do I continuously improve it, that's a great way to start down this path.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nepkron. I'm talking to John Rossman. He is the author of The Amazon Way, and we're trying to tease out lessons of things that Amazon does, the way they do business, services they sell, that might have implications for all of us, whether we're running a small business, managing a small business, or simply in our career in terms of the kind of jobs and careers that will likely be burgeoning in the future era. Now, one of the things that Amazon is known for is really how easy it is to navigate their system, you know, including getting my questions answered. Does Amazon have a secret sauce that might be applicable to my listeners who are managers or own their own business about easy to find?
Yeah, there's no simple answer to any of these things. These are good questions. You know, one of the leadership principles at Amazon is invent and simplify. And I think simplify is really the key word in that. And so if there's, you know, a secret sauce, it's how to make it obvious and how to make it really simple in plain terms, in plain English, easily understood, making it integrated so that I don't have to do the same thing in multiple times. So that's one. And then I think the other thing that they do is they make, you know, small refinements, small changes, and then they measure the impact, and then they continue to adjust. And so the reason Amazon's, you know, so good from a, you know, user interface standpoint, why it's so obvious, is they've been at it for a long time, and they don't stand still. They continue to work small refinements to continue to try to improve that.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. The simplicity, I think about, you know, when I go and I, you know, I haven't received my item yet, which never happens. It always seems to get there sooner than I expect. It, you know, there's, where's my stuff is the option, or want to return, it's easy. It really is very plain English.
Yeah, and they work to make it predictive too, right? The, you know, knowing that you're probably going to have that question, they send you an order confirmation email immediately, or they send you shipment updates. And so they're, you know, they're proactive in understanding, you know, customers are typically going to have that type of question, and they like understanding that.
Yeah, that's a great point. I want to turn to, you know, one of the things that when we talked on the off the air, you said you've got a criticism of Amazon, which makes sense. It's wondering now that they're starting to finally, they're actually only now finally starting to make a profit. A station like KALW, believe that corporations do have an obligation to give a good chunk of their profit to, like, nonprofit endeavors like building playgrounds in the community. And but there are other people say that that kind of thing is what our taxes and our donations to nonprofits are supposed to be doing. That companies should do what they know how to do. They're not social service agencies. In Amazon's case, they should do more to make more products available that are easy for customers to evaluate, easy for customers to buy, easy to get them delivered promptly, and not reallocate their funds to building basketball courts. From where you sit, as an Amazon executive for 4 years, what do you think Amazon actually needs to do more to donate more of its profits to nonprofit endeavors?
Yeah, and it's not really a criticism. I think it's just the observation that, you know, Amazon's no longer the, you know, scrappy startup that's, you know, battling to survive. And I think internally they like to keep that kind of persona and energy because it helps, you know, keep people motivated and optimistic about the future. And, you know, Jeff's always talking about it's still day one. But, you know, as they're becoming a global company, I think that responsibilities come with that. And, you know, everything you said, which is all of those players need to, you know, play a role in this. But, you know, there is a role for large companies to play in their communities. And it's not separate from shareholder interests or shareholder values. And so, you know, Amazon does do some things. They do some nice programs with hiring veterans and really making that a priority and everything. But I think that they're coming into a place in as a company where they're probably going to have to think about how do I do more and how do I make it both a win for the community as well as, you know, a win for the shareholders. And I think that that can be done, you know, fairly straightforward.
I want to ask you, end with a kind of softball question. One thing, one lesson that either Jeff Bezos as the CEO or just Amazon as a company could teach us on how to be better either on our jobs individually in our careers or, you know, in our role in coordinating, managing, leading a business. What haven't we discussed that you want to make sure our listeners hear?
Well, I think for an individual, one of the Amazon leadership principles is having a bias for action, and that it's, you know, it's important to analyze, it's important to study, it's important to get input, but, you know, it's important to make progress and to try something, and just the motion of putting things into motion, trying them, and then adjusting, you're typically far ahead than sitting there and overanalyzing it. We talk a lot about not admiring the problem too long. And so I think that might be one on an individual basis, which is, you know, having a bias for action in your work and in making improvements.
Well, you have made an improvement to work with Marty Nemco. I am deeply apologetic. that we have, you know, had this terrible sound quality, but hopefully it hasn't been too intolerable for you. Are you there?
Yeah, absolutely. No, this has been fine for me, and really appreciate the conversation.
It's my pleasure. And the book, again, is The Amazon Way. John Rossman is the author. Probably the easiest way to find it is, ironically, on Amazon.com.
Of course.
John, thanks very much for giving me part of your Sunday.
Great. Thank you very much.
Take care. And again, I do apologize to you for the previously bad sound quality. Now we are back to normal. I've just arrived after there was a 10-car accident on the Bay Bridge. This is the first time, I think, in the 25 years that I've been on the show that I have not been here on time. Anyway, but I'm really glad to be here, and I'm here for you. So if you or someone you love has got a work-related problem, this is the time to call. I do what are called workovers, and the purpose of a workover is not to pummel you. The purpose of a workover is hopefully to be of help, support, advice, whatever. The phone number here, if you or someone you love has got a career conundrum, whether you're unemployed, well-employed and still unhappy, wondering about a problem with a coworker, any kind of a workplace dilemma, conundrum, that is fair game. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko on at KALW 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And while we're waiting for you to call in, I think what I'll do is I enjoy always sharing some cool careers for you, and so I think I will start by doing that. One of the things as we boomers get older, we are thinking about retirement. I guess I'm not there yet. I'm probably, hopefully, 10 years, 20 years from that. But certainly people in their 50s and 60s are starting to think in that direction. And whether it be in a, you know, if it's your own small business or not so small business, you're an executive, you're wanting to find somebody who's going to going to replace you and perhaps ensure that your legacy is intact and that it doesn't fall apart. So there is a whole series of people called succession planning consultants who are in that business. So if that's something that you think you might enjoy doing, I think that's an under-the-radar career that's quite good. I do want to give out the phone number again. If you or someone you love has got a career problem, this is a great time to call. Usually what happens is the lines fill up toward the end of the hour, and then you can't get on the air. So if you have wanted for a while to perhaps get some career help, this is a great time to call. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Another career that I wanted to tout. We all keep hearing about healthcare careers, healthcare careers, healthcare careers. And, you know, there isn't necessarily a shortage anymore in nursing or in physical therapists or doctors anymore. But there are these under-the-radar healthcare careers. And one of them, which I really like, is surgical technologist. Why do I like surgical technologist? Because the training is relatively short. I think they keep ratcheting it up all the time, all training. But I think it's under 2 years. And you are working in the operating room. You're prepping the patient typically, then you're setting up the operating room with the equipment and the machines and whatever. And you're also there. You are the person who may be handing the scalpel or whatever to the surgeon when he or she is asking for it. And so you're part of the life and death drama of the operating room. It's the last career in the world that I'd want to do. Hospitals freak me out, but ironic in that I'm going to be supervising medical students and we're going to be in the hospital all the time, but that's another story. Anyway, surgical technologist, another under-the-radar career. Many, many people who listen to KELW tend to care a lot about community. The word community comes out, I think, more than almost any word I listen to on the station. There many, many companies have a community affairs person, whether it be media companies, you know, TV stations, radio stations, or corporations. Everybody is concerned these days about relations with the community. So there is a wonderful opportunity for those of you who are community-minded, a community affairs director. Another career that I love, many people go into teaching, public school teaching, but then leave it because it is a burnout profession. They say that roughly 40% leave within the first 3 to 5 years. It is an extremely difficult job, especially with our mixed ability classes where you have special ed and gifted kids in the same class. You have limited English speakers. You have kids with mental disabilities who now, because of mainstream, are in the class. And we have the ever more ratcheted up curriculum with the Common Core, which is extremely difficult. And the demand that every student learn that Common Core. Where is the diversity, the call for diversity when we really need it in terms of what different kids' learning needs? But anyway, teaching is a burnout profession. So very often teachers decide they love the idea of helping children grow and learn. Tutoring is great as a wonderful career. No, it doesn't have the stability and you do have to do marketing. But the hourly rate can be quite good, and the demand is so enormous for tutors. Parents are frustrated that because in the classroom there is such a wide range of student functioning that their kids' needs often aren't met. And so they are willing to pay, you know, at least middle-class people can afford to pay $50, $75, $100 an hour. And if it's a special needs kid, like a kid with autism, even more than that. And because it's one-to-one, it's something that can be, you're not overwhelmed by the enormity of the task. You know, one kid, you can identify their individual needs. You can help figure out how to motivate that child. You can develop that intimate relationship. And it's one of the few businesses that doesn't require much startup costs. You know, even if you're living in a hovel yourself and you can't have students come to you, you could come to them. You could come to in fact, I'm sure the parents generally appreciate your coming to them or meeting at a Starbucks or whatever. Tutoring, I believe, is one of the most rewarding careers. I want to give out the phone number again. If you or someone you love would like some career help, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko for what I call a workover is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I love my doggy Einstein, for those of you who know. I always, you know, I talk about him with some regularity. And I appreciate veterinarians. My brother-in-law is a veterinarian. He loves his career. And in fact, most veterinarians I know and have spoken with over the years love their career. It is a difficult career to get into. It is not easy to get into vet school. But, you know, even in tough financial times, people will spend on their pets. And so it tends to be pretty recession resistant. You know, it's just a career that I think is unusually rewarding. And unlike with human healthcare, where it is so bureaucratic, you know, there's so much paperwork, so much complications with the exchanges in Obamacare. And then there's other insurers outside of the exchanges, private insurers and paperwork and fee for service, which is going away. But it's just a mammothly complex process dealing with humans. It is less so with animals. So I think veterinary medicine is just a wonderful career for the right person, as always. What else do I want to tell you about? Let's see. I want to go away from that and just I'm going to move to just a potpourri. I assemble these potpourri of career tips that I like to share with you. And so one is, you know, as I think back on all of my clients, one of the most common reasons that people are failing to have a successful career is what I call the Peter Pan syndrome. They do refuse to grow up. It's hard, especially when you see that people are asked to work harder, longer, for less money, less job security, ever more complex, interdisciplinary. You're not just in your own silo. You got to be, one day you got to know something about finance, the next day about marketing, the next day about fundraising, whatever. People can just say, ah, the hell with it. I think I'd rather go to Nepal and try to find nirvana and find the answer, or, you know, volunteer as an activist for their favorite nonprofit or whatever. And I can't say that there is a time to grow up. There are some people who say, to hell with it. I just want to travel and hang out. And even if I got to live with my parents or be a live off of somebody else, my romantic partner or whatever, then to hell with it. I still want to play. I want to do whatever I want to do. But at least I invite you to ask yourself, have you reached the moment, or is it, we could be talking here about your kid. Have you or the person you love reached the time where they really need to ask themselves, am I inappropriately guilty of the Peter Pan syndrome, where I continue to play the procrastination game and think I can get away with it like I was in college, or the procrastination game where I think I'll just be a barista and hang out. I don't need to really be serious about my career. There is no right or wrong, but it's just a question I wanted to raise, and I like the term Peter Pan syndrome. I'm a big fan of metaphors, and the metaphor I'd like to use about the job hunt is that it's like a video game. There are, it really is like that. You do in the video game, you end up wandering around a long time until you find somebody who'll give you anything. Then you finally get some little thing, you know, some gold coins, or you meet a sage who gives you this great advice. And then you'll meet some monster, like in the career sense, it's a monster who would tell you, forget it, you're not hireable, you can't get a job. But then eventually you meet fairy godmothers, and the fairy godmother shepherds you to the Holy Grail. And so, because people tend to get so serious about the job search and get overwhelmed by it, they can either be that they either give up prematurely, or they end up sounding desperate and they get too intense about it. Having the mindset of it is a game, like a video game. Yes, you try to take the game seriously, you try to win, but you can always press reset, and that you're going to meet monsters, you're going to meet mages, and treating it like this adventure. I'm not saying that any metaphor is going to magically make it fun. I think it's dishonest to say that looking for a job can be made fun. But maybe some of the edge can be taken off if you think of it potentially as a video game. I'll give out the phone number again. Phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco. If you'd like a 3-minute career makeover or workover, whatever you want to call, sometimes it takes 10 minutes, sometimes two. In any case, the price is right. Zero, zippo, nada. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help? Hello?
Okay, so here's my... I want to make a comment about what you said about veterinarians.
Sure.
If they have not experienced any reduction due to this climate, I think they're going to. A lot of people I know are very disgruntled about how they've become... they've modeled the human... medical care. What am I trying to say? It's like going to a regular doctor for a human being. They throw a lot of medical stuff at you. They make a lot of last-ditch efforts to save pets who should be euthanized, who should be encouraged to be euthanized, and they're very expensive. I can't afford it anymore. I won't be able to replace my pet when he goes, and he's going to go soon because he's old. And I'm not going to do any of that bullshit, you know, if he has cancer or whatever. He's going to be euthanized. I don't like the model that they've adopted is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I want to thank you for the call. You know, it is an interesting point in terms of it applies, I believe, equally to humans as well as animals. You know, when I hear about people with advanced cancer and the doctors continue to to torture the patients with expensive, resource-using procedures, cosmically, is that the wisest use of our resources? Of course, I guess a person should have the right to choose to have that if he can afford it or she can afford it. But especially under our ever-growing kind of community-oriented, group-paid health plan, whether it be through insurance or through Obamacare, your choosing to use medical resources raises the cost to everybody, and whether it's a human or an animal. And I think, you know, while the right has criticized this as death panels or whatever, but I think it's ethical and right to take a hard look at the way in which we allocate healthcare resources, whether it's fee-for-service or even societal. Tough, tough issues. But I think it applies both to human medicine as well as to animal medicine. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi.
Hi.
Am I on the air?
You are.
I am. Hi there. I love your show. Very much appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
I am 26, mm-hmm. female, and I do believe I have the Peter Pan syndrome.
Okay.
Professionally in my career, I've done a number of things from teaching elementary kids, working backstage, working on stage, costume maintenance.
I love that stuff, too. I love that stuff, too.
Yeah, I love that stuff, too. But I found that it wasn't lucrative, at least not in the city, and currently working in hospitality.
Right. So waitress kind of thing?
Waitress, well, managing.
Yeah, okay. So you could say to me either of two things. You know, the older I get, the less judgmental I get. You could say, to hell with it. You know what? I'm still 26. I don't have a family. So I live with three roommates, or I live with my parents. You know, I love my life. I like playing around with theater. I love costuming. I don't mind, you know, managing, you know, in a restaurant or whatever.
Sure.
Or you could say, damn it, you know what? I really do want to change. What do you really, in your heart of hearts, what do you really want?
Oh, I want to be successful in a place of entertainment.
Tell me more.
let's see. It's honestly hard to envision. I used to live in New York, and I appreciated that scene more. I think there's more possibility. I've found that San Francisco, there's so many artists, and yet there's this huge class with business and technology, and they're not coming together. And I honestly see myself in that realm as well.
You said you liked okay, I want to understand all that. So you say you can see yourself in that realm. Tell me where. I want to understand what the picture is. You said so many things. You said you love the idea of being part of the scene. I want to understand that. That could give us some clues. You know you'd like to be in entertainment. In what role? Paint a picture. You also say that you could see yourself in the business world, in the tech world in some way. Flesh that out for me, and maybe we can figure out how to integrate it all.
Right. That's what I've been trying to fuse together.
All right, so let me start. You're struggling, so let me make it easy. Let's say I said, here's what you're going to do. You know, did you want to be on stage? You like being on stage. So let's say we say you're going to be a trainer. So your day job is going to be a trainer for companies and nonprofits or whatever in something, whether it be in fundraising or customer service or communications or diversity, whatever the hell it is. You're going to learn how to do that, and you're going to be this awesome performer. You're going to be doing these workshops. And then
at night, you're going to
still do costuming. You're going to still do plays. You're going to do all this stuff on the weekends. So that's how you integrate it all. What feels right and wrong about that combination of avoiding the Peter Pan syndrome?
No, that feels very good. I mean, that sounds very good. I've just also noticed that I've, in the midst of trying to flush this out, I'm burning out as well, because I do work nights, I work days, and currently in the profession I'm in, it's not paying bills.
Right, it's crap. No, you got to get out of that because that's dead end.
Yeah, I got to get out of that. Yeah.
So if we said that the path out is to in the short term work on getting some skills as a trainer, for example, and this is the way Marty Nemco would do it. I would pick a niche in training that I cared about. Like, let's say, if you were training for corporations, I mentioned some things. I mentioned, you know, there's things like sexual harassment, there's communication, there's customer service, there's sales. What do you believe?
Communication.
Okay.
Yeah.
If I were in your shoes, I would do the following, and you tell me whether you would want to do this or not. I would watch YouTube videos like TED Talks or whatever, the very best talks on communication, and I would learn whatever I could from watching. You're going to learn more from watching than from reading. I'd watch, and I'd be taking notes, and I'd say, all right, great, I want to make sure I do that. Nah, I don't like that, I'm not going to do that. So you make a note of what you like, and you see it, and you feel it. Then you pull out a webcam or a camcorder, and you start pretending you're going to give a talk on communication skills. If you don't know enough about it, read some articles to give you the content on what does it take to be a great communicator in a corporate setting, let's say. You know, and so you craft a talk on that, not scripted so much, but some major, interesting, not obvious talking points, because you don't want to say the obvious. Well, it's important to be a good listener. Garbage. Everybody knows that. So you want to come up with great, non-obvious content, really cool activities that are interactive, and then you turn on your webcam or your camcorder, and you go and you make a demo, and then you criticize the hell out of it. You say, this is stupid. I was dumb. I was too fast. I was too slow. I was too touchy-feely. I was too this. Whatever it is, you are ruthless in criticizing yourself, and you keep doing it until you feel good about it, and then you show your videos to your friends who you trust, who are not going to say, you're so great, that's great. No, you want to show it to friends who you like, who you respect, who will give you, who will praise you when it's deserved, absolutely, but who will criticize it when they must, and you keep working on it until you have a demo you feel damn proud of. Then you send that demo to 50 companies or nonprofits, whoever the hell you want to work for. And I'm using the word hell a lot today. I don't know why. I'm getting on a roll.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Anyway, you send it to as many people as you possibly can who are, for example, directors of trainings at organizations you want to work for. And you tell your true story. You say you're 26 and your real love is theater, but you know you can't make a living in theater or whatever, and so you're figuring you're trying to amalgamate it all by being a trainer. Here is your demo. And that's my best guess as to how you make the transition from waitress supervisor to making a living and still not giving up your soul. How does that sound?
That sounds wonderful. Thank you so much, Marty.
You're most welcome. I thank you for calling Work with Marty Nemco. I appreciate it. I'm happy to help you. If you want me to use hell on you, feel free to call the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Let's go back to the phones. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. My name's Sarah, and I'm actually calling for a friend of mine, if that's all right.
Sure, absolutely.
She's a mature woman who had a long-standing, very successful career in the medical field, just below a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And then she had a stroke.
Mm-hmm.
And that was quite a few years ago. But the residual on a stroke is that, although you'd never, ever guess that she'd had a stroke if you looked at her, she has a very hard time completing tasks quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So she applies for a job. She gets the job based on her stellar, curriculum vitae or whatever you call it.
Yeah, curriculum vitae.
But then not too long into the job, they're dissatisfied with the time it's taking her to complete tasks.
Right.
And she loses the job.
Right.
So what she's wondering is, how can she present this situation to her future employer without actually disqualifying herself?
Yeah, I don't. What you said, she was just below an MD. What was she actually doing?
She's a nurse practitioner.
Great. Yeah, and her expertise is in what?
In psychiatry.
Great. So what if I said she needs to be, when you're hired by an employer, they're much more likely to impose very rigorous time demands. What if I said she needs to be a freelance consultant to HMOs and the like, doing case review, or for law firms doing psychiatric case review where there isn't a particular time pressure? In other words, there's no lawsuit filed yet. Maybe that's even a better example. In the case of insurance companies, they have to give answers, yes or no, they're going to cover or not cover very quickly. But in law firms, they're going to get all these claims that are made, for a lawsuit or whatever, and they don't have to act right away. And so if she was there to paid on a case-by-case basis to be doing case review of these claims. Nurses are often used, and certainly nurse practitioners, are often used for case review. What do you think about that idea?
Well, the only downside of that is that she really enjoys patient contact. So, I don't know.
Patient contact is it is very real time. If she's a slow processor now, she's not going to engender the trust that's necessary in a patient. If the patient, says something, and then she's got to have a very quick follow-up answer or a follow-up question or whatever. And if she's very hesitant and slow processing,
well, the odd thing is that the feedback she gets from her patients is excellent. They actually really appreciate the fact that she isn't such a speedo. But the problem is more with her employer in terms of the time it takes her to process paperwork.
Okay.
That's more the issue.
So let's see. Is there a kind of clinical work that she does very well, where there isn't?
What she's currently doing is working with a psychiatrist where she sees part of his caseload to do an intake and then determine what would be a likely good medication regime for that person, and then the psychiatrist goes over it. And that works pretty well, but it hasn't been all that lucrative for her.
So, okay, so maybe we don't need a career change here or just a little career tweak. So that, for example, if she is, let's say, I mean, why wouldn't she, if it's not, if the problem is not the kind of work, were money, psychiatrists make a fortune per hour, should she simply market herself that way, that she is somebody who can do kind of intake and routine check-in kind of care, and just pitch other psychiatrists for that exact kind of work so that collectively she can make enough money, or does that feel wrong?
No, I think if she had a little more confidence in herself such that she could kind of increase her caseload, that she could probably do what she's doing now, and she actually enjoys it. But I think she, because of mistakes made in the past, she's very kind of like hesitant about everything she does.
Sure.
All
you know, confidence, though, confidence falls is of one of two types. There's a legitimate lack of self-confidence. For example, if I were to play basketball for the Golden State Warriors, I would have terrible lack of self-confidence that I could do well, but that's based in reality. If indeed her stroke is causing her to make mistakes and work very slowly, then that lack of confidence, especially because we're talking about patients, you know, life and well-being, is to be honored, not to be, you know, let's not just give her the typical phony self-confidence boosting activities. In what specific areas she does feel competent and confident, even if it's much lower level work, where does she feel relaxed and confident?
I would say she also has had some work doing more almost like a home health aide, like, you know, except that she's paid more of a nursing. Well, it's like home nursing. That doesn't pay all that well. But, you know, I guess it's around $20-$25 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
But she is extremely confident in that. She, you know, she knows she does a good job, and then, you know, it's something she can do.
Well, I'm wondering whether we need a hybrid. You know, I think being a home health aide full-time, is, especially in psychiatric, could be very draining. You don't want to do that full-time. But maybe if she did a small amount of this, you know, patient intake work for psychiatrists, which is going to be less draining, and then a little bit of the home health aide, which is something she feels very confident in, that might kill two birds with one stone, get her more income, but without the relentless driving pressure of having to be a high performer all the time. What do you think about that?
Well, that's pretty much her strategy now, but she doesn't seem to be making enough money. And to tell you the truth, I wonder whether, it's interesting I called today, whether she has a little bit of the Peter Pan thing going on, that because of her, you know, that she's been out of work for so long, it's sort of hard for her to ramp herself up to really make it, you know. And so she's really, you know, she's feeling like she's not making enough money, but it's hard for her to get ramped up to make enough money, you know, even though she probably could if she really put her shoulder behind it. But, you know, I don't know, because I don't know how much of that is actually, you know, quote unquote psychological, or how much is actually a result of the stroke.
What would you guess? You sound like you care about her deeply. If you were, sometimes people just need somebody to push them. Like some parents need to, you know, push their kids, and that helps. And sometimes the pushy parent is no good. What if you took the lead on this? What if you made the list of people, like, say, psychiatrists or home health agencies for her to contact, and you just put it in front of her so that you've kind of taken the first step and made it easy for her? Do you think that's a very symptomatic approach that could, you know, that might not get to the underlying psychological issue, but sometimes we don't need to. What's your intuition as to if you simply made her a list of people to contact or write, that would be enough to push her over the edge to make those inquiries?
It might be, because she does, you know, she is constantly looking for work. I've never seen somebody so dedicated to getting off of disability as she is. So it might be, you know, that might be helpful, and maybe feeling kind of like she has a coach or a cheerleader.
So explain that paradox. On the one hand, you say she's not, well, you say she may have the Peter Pan syndrome, not willing to do very much, and yet you say you've never seen anybody work so hard to look for a job.
Well, I guess what I mean is that she seems to be constantly making efforts, but somehow it doesn't materialize into something that creates an income that she feels like she could, live on.
Well, the question,
she's very worried about that.
Right. The question is, are her efforts, you know, is it, you know, she sounds like she's making a lot of effort, but if there was a goddess and the goddess were looking down, would the goddess say she's not getting hired because she's simply not good at this point because of her stroke or whatever? Or would the goddess say it's something else?
I'd say something else. My gut thing is, and I'm kind of reluctant to, you know, lay some kind of judgment trip on her, is that she's something's in between her and making it work. And I don't think it has much to do with anything except whatever's going on inside of her. Whatever that, you know.
So maybe that's your first step, because she's not on the phone with us. Maybe you need to give her a hug and say, you know, it pains me tremendously to see you wanting more work and somehow not being able to unlock yourself. And ask her this question, which is a question I love to ask. Play shrink with yourself. Whatever her name, I'll make, say her name is Mary. Mary, play shrink with yourself. What do you think? And oh, here's how I would do it. No, I would make up I'd make a circle on a big piece of paper, and I'd say, this is a pie chart. There are many reasons why somebody doesn't get a job. I'd like you to divide this pie chart up in proportion to why you think you're not getting a job. How much is motivation? How much is fear? How much is anger? How much is lack of skills? And divide it up and use that pie chart as a trigger for conversation. How does that feel?
Yeah, that would be good, because I think she'd be much more open to something that was sort of more coming from her than from me.
That's always true. It's true of me as a career counselor. If the idea comes from me, the chances are far lower than of it being implemented than if I can just ask facilitating questions to get the idea to come from the client.
Right.
They call it the not invented here syndrome. We're all subject to it.
Yeah.
Anyway, I appreciate that you love her enough to be caring this much, and I hope that helped just a little bit, at least.
Yeah, it did.
Okay.
Thank
you take care. Thanks very much. Thanks very much for calling Work with Marty Nemko. And that basically is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I don't, you know, as usual, the people waited to the last minute. We can't get you on the air, so I apologize. Please do call next week, though. You know, I will. Actually, I won't next week. Next week is a pledge drive week. We don't take phone calls. But in 2 weeks, certainly you can. But next week, I got a really good show. I'm really excited about it. Let me tell you about that just briefly. My wife, Barbara Nemko, is going to be on the show with me. And we are going to debate how young people and the older people who love them should explore possible careers, majors, college, graduate schools. So basically, advice for young people and the people who love them. So that is, I do always want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please do join me again next Sunday at 11. Until then, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we do find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.